This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, the second Shobi, and finally a new sponsor for the show, Simply Fix It, a company that repairs iPads for schools. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you doing?
I'm absolutely fantastic. Day before the last day for... tomorrow is our last day before Thanksgiving, so
okay.
we get a whole week. So the way it works is like in the U.S. is some schools get a week off for fall break and then a partial for Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. and then vice versa. And so we do the short fall break and then the long Thanksgiving break, which as in I prefer that because the kids are ready for a break at this point in the year. So is the staff.
Yeah, definitely. We're looking at another 5 weeks until our next holiday, which, you know, tiny violins are playing for every teacher in the world as you say that, but being in a building with other people's children every day is, you've earned it at that point, I think.
I agree. So before we kind of get into our main topic today, which is a Ask Out of School type week, listener mailbag going through that, I want to talk about something that I am doing personally in the month of November, mm-hmm. And explain how it's affecting my life. I always have a 5 o'clock shadow. I've had a 5 o'clock shadow for like 2 years. So like my wife and I've been married like, I don't know, like 6 years. And one day, like I kind of grew a little facial hair and she was like, I like that. So I just kind of kept a little facial hair. Just not real thick.
Did you know just the day that we're recording is in fact International Men's Day? So in honor of that, there you go.
There's a day for everything's a day for something.
Yes, indeed. It's also International Toilet Day. Sorry.
I like toilets. I'm a fan of those personally.
Yes.
They work well, and I'm glad they exist. So I want to say all this, like this is descriptive narration in my life, mm-hmm. and this is not prescriptive advice for everyone else's lives. And I'm always careful to say that, like when I make statements about things like absolutes, in terms mm-hmm. of like the only thing to me that's absolute in life is my religion. Everything other than that is like, you know, it's everybody can kind of decide for themselves. And only thing I won't change my mind about is religion and my family. Everything else, you know, again, my life's always in flux. Always reminded of when Jeff Bezos told the guys at 37 Signals, he views the ability to change your mind quickly as a sign of a good leader. So I have that, okay. I guess. So I noticed this when I was off on paternity leave that the more I kept up with what was happening in work and the more I realized of how far I was behind, mm-hmm. the more overwhelmed I felt. And so it was just about like Tuesday of being off. I'd been off like 4 days. And then like talking to my wife and her point was, if you don't disconnect, you'll always be behind and you'll know how far you're behind. And we're always like, we always have things to do at work. And sometimes like constantly looking at things you have to do, mm-hmm. like it makes you even more anxious about those things and want to do them. And I'm very type A, and I don't like things to hang over my head for too long, and I like mm-hmm. to complete projects and complete them well and move on to the next one. So I, for the month of November, I guess I'll steal the term from CGP Gray of the Hello Internet and Cortex podcast. I am dialing down in the month of November, particularly with social media mm-hmm. and ways I consume information. So again, I stole all this from CGP Gray, and I will link to his blog and the episode of Cortex where they talk about how he did this in his life. And again, one of the main goals here is to reduce things I have to think about, or things I do think about. Mm-hmm. And so here's kind of what I did. I deleted all social media from my phone. I don't have a Facebook account. I have an Instagram account, and I have a Twitter account. So I deleted those from my phone. Now I have since then posted on Instagram, but I will download the app, post, and then delete the app again. I realize that is stupid, but that's what I'm doing. I have checked Twitter, or I was checking Twitter on the mobile site to see if I didn't see if I had any new DMs. Like, I wish there was a way like an app where I could just like see Twitter DMs, because I view those differently as like everything else. But that became like a habit. So in one blocker, I have now blocked twitter.com from Safari, And for me to re-enable that, I have to go in there and either disable that rule or disable one blocker. So it's just another thing. It's multiple steps to be able to disable that. My mail is back on manual, so it does not check itself until I open the app. And I also signed out of non like mission critical Slack channels on my iPhone. And so I don't know if you're this way, but like I went from like one Slack channel to about six I'm a part of.
Yeah.
For like various freelance things I'm involved with, and some of them are like more fun than others. And so I signed out of all non-essential ones. Like if I miss like I need to be notified of the, like there are four that I'm signed in on. Like I want to have access to those at all times. Mm-hmm. So I'm signed out of like three more.
Sounds like you're pretty serious about it.
I'm very serious. Very serious. I have deleted all but three podcasts from my phone.
Mm-hmm.
I've whittled that down to three. We're probably down from like say 10 or 15. I am making it a conscious effort to a few days a week drive to work in complete silence. And I deleted RSS from my phone. And I also unsubscribed from everything in Apple News that I was using. Mm-hmm. So no RSS, no Apple News. So ultimately, like I said, I'm trying to reduce things I think about and how they distract me, and trying to think more about like the things I want to accomplish. And I took Sean Blanc's focus course a few months ago,
okay,
and which is very good. And one of the things it helped me realize is the things I want to spend my time with are things related to my religion. So like being of the Christian faith, I would spend time in the Bible. And spend time in prayer,
mm-hmm.
Family, close friends, and working out and work, and you know, particularly like making money. It's like I do things work wise that make money, like either my full time job or I will write an article for someone. So like those things are ultimately how I spend my time and want to spend my time. I like to work out, stay in shape. I love spending time with my family and friends. And when I say like friends, I obviously don't hang out with them daily because I am a father of three and married and busy. So I make it a point like multiple times a week to iMessage with friends. How you doing? Just it's one of those things where it's so easy to not text people, but it's so easy to text people. And so I make a point to do it just because it's like you can go a month without talking to someone otherwise.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah.
So – yeah, it's like it takes nothing. Just text someone, and say, "Hey, how's your week been?" Like it's nothing, and it may strike a longer conversation. It may not. And so I also don't watch near as much TV as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
I did that a few months ago. Like we don't have cable, and I really whittled down like what shows I watch. I watch about three with my wife, and I've kind of come back to music as a hobby,
mm-hmm.
and I'm listening to music more and more. In times when I would used to watch TV. And it's replaced audiobooks for me largely.
That's interesting.
And the reason is music is not a task to complete. Like where audiobooks are, like I have finished this book, I have not.
Mm-hmm.
Podcasts are, I have finished this book, this podcast, I have not finished them.
Yeah.
I am like a completionist. Like I would like to do things and then be done with them.
Mm-hmm.
With music, I don't have that. So a lot of times after we get my two older kids to bed, my wife like may go run on the treadmill, and I will hold and spend some time with my newborn. And a lot of times, in years past, with my previous kids, I would spend that time goofing off on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do now is I use my Apple TV, turn on some music I want to listen to, and just sit back and listen to that. Think, look at my daughter, and just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really trying to be bored more and. Just leave more time for thinking and trying to clear my head. I sit there and like kind of thought about the way things like were before all this social media. And again, I love social media. I'm not saying I'm getting rid of social media,
mm-hmm.
but I'm trying to put it in its place in my life and make it where it's useful for me, but doesn't become addicting. And so what I do, I only check like Twitter. I only get on Twitter on my Mac, okay. And I maybe check it two or three times a day,
mm-hmm.
and reply to people or see what's new. And so I'm making it like a focused activity on a certain device that I'm not on that much, all things considered.
Yeah.
And so, again, I know all this may sound crazy talk to a lot of you, but this is kind of what I've done in my life to bring some clarity to it. And it is a very much a first world problem that I'm doing this. But it is something that I'm doing in November as a test, and it's working so well at this point in the month, I don't ever see a time when I will change that again.
Yeah, I can definitely detect a kind of theme of this going around at the moment. I think people are, I don't know if it's just kind of world events or whatever it is, but you know, I was increasingly find Twitter to be a sort of place of almost unrelenting negativity. You know, and I think Twitter was fun at one time, and now it's just it kind of feels not so much fun anymore. I mean, I think maybe 2 winters ago, I just had a kind of a breakdown is way too strong, you know, and far too medical to put it, but I just kind of got fed up with everything that was going on, and I unfollowed all but about 16 people on Twitter, and then I've since built it back up to about 215 or something like that. But I find that to be incredibly valuable. Like, you know, it's amazing how many people you let into your life through something like that. And of course, you do it by choice. You don't do it. It's not forced upon you. But you can kind of get into a situation. And I had got into the situation where I was sort of following a whole bunch of people who I thought I was having some kind of relationship with, and then you realize that none of them are following you back, and it's not really a two-way street. So I'm not saying that I only follow people who follow me back, but I think I've been a lot more judicious about who I follow and who gets to stay. And you know, people go through periods in their life where they're, you know, maybe they're going through a hard time in their life or whatever, and their tone becomes incredibly negative. And I know I've done that as well. I'm not saying I'm always positive on Twitter, because sometimes I'm not, but you sometimes find people who just get into the cycle of they're using Twitter as like a public support and shaming channel for companies that they deal with, you know, and it's, you know, it's just public complaints to this company or that company. And particularly when they do that trick where they sort of do hey at whoever. What's the problem with your bagels today or whatever? And he's like, well, why are you broadcasting that to everybody? You know, and the reason you're doing it is to get your cause more attention about the whatever problem you had with your bagels the other day. And I think that kind of thing, you know, people who do that too much were particularly in my firing line, because that was becoming incredibly tedious. And I know I've noticed other people also saying, you know, recognizing for themselves, I've been really negative on Twitter, I'm going to try and change that. And I think that's something I don't want to bring too much of that into my life as well. But again, there are some people who are negative for good reasons as well. And it's there are certainly things worth being negative about from time to time.
I wonder if this is like an outflow of the U.S. political season heating up for the U.S. president.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I have political views and I have, my opinions. But I know that no one listens to this podcast, reads my blog, or follows me on Twitter for my political opinions. And so I'm okay with that. And honestly, I mean, everybody, like, no politician is perfect and nobody's views are perfect. And so I just kind of stay out of that argument, because it does nothing but cause disagreements and anger among people who feel differently. And that is not, I don't feel like that is the appropriate place to discuss that. Just as like, I choose to don't debate people on Twitter about religion.
Yep.
I just don't feel like that's the appropriate place to do that. And I don't feel like it'll do any good. People can pretty much sum up how I believe, and that's fine. And I've had offline conversations with people about that, and those have been constructive and helpful and on both ends. Mm-hmm. But I just don't feel like 140 characters is the place to do that. I kind of cleaned up my followers list, like who I follow, and I'm kind of the same way. Like if it's someone that doesn't follow me back who. I just don't feel like it has a reason not to. Like, we've interacted a lot in the past. I just, not rude, but like maybe we just did the same thing, like kind of unfollowed them. And then, I follow a lot of people that like have, because I don't have a lot of followers by any means, mm-hmm. but I have more than like 10. And I love people like interact with me a lot, mm-hmm. and like have constructive things to say, or like add positivity, positive comments to my life based on things I write or things I tweet about. Those are the kind of people I want to follow and get to know better. And I don't know. I'm just trying. I think you kind of summed up. I'm trying to surround my life with like more positivity, and by relegating this like on a device that I don't always have with me. Like when we're at dinner, I don't feel the need. Like if my wife goes to the restroom, I don't feel the need to check Twitter. Where like 6 months ago, well, as soon as she gets up, that's the first thing I'm checking.
Yeah.
It's like, why am I doing that? Like, this is stupid. Like, who even cares? Like, why can't I just like sit here and like stare at the wall?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right to stare at the wall. No question about it.
So that's my life. And so if that was boring to you, I'm sorry. I have found CGP Gray and Mike Hurley talking about this aspect on Cortex to be incredibly positive in my life. And so I thought maybe I can share some positive feedback on that with somebody else. And, you know, like I had this conversation with a coworker today about this, and he was asking me about it. And he said, you know, I think like the world and technology and like social interaction like is a pendulum, and we're like at peak social.
Yeah.
And it's going to like swing the other way. And I'm not saying like I am ever going to be a hermit, but, you know, I'm getting to the place where I love technology in my life, but I don't want it to be like something that is requires so much of my attention. That's why I love like the Nest. The Nest is a great home technology device, requires zero attention of mine to use. I'm not interested in automating my home and maintaining that. And so I'm just like trying to, I guess, like simplify my life in some ways and also make it more positive and more focused on the things that really matter to me in life. And I'm not, you know, again, I love Twitter because I've met a lot of neat people on Twitter, and you know, you and I know each other because of Twitter, but it came to a place where it was too much in my life, and I allow things I read and see on Instagram and read on Twitter and were said to me on Twitter to affect my mood and day too much and require way too much of my attention. And so I'm kind of trying to like take a little bit of a step back from that.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. I had a thing where, you remember when I did that thing on Twitter after we had the iPad Pro preview, where it was, I just invited people to ask me a question on Twitter about what my experience had been with the iPad Pro. And there was one guy who just, you know, took unbelievable exception to this. And he was just quote tweeting just all kinds of, you know, not offensive and with a capital O, but just, you know, derogatory statements. You know, he was saying, you know, this guy's had an hour with an iPad and thinks he knows everything, so why don't you ask him a question, sort of thing. And I think more and more I'm just kind of like block on Twitter, you know, and I think it's I'm not a hair trigger blocker, but I certainly think that you know, people who your first interaction with them is negative, you're probably going to have another one that's negative. And I don't think they just because you're public on the internet means that they get to come into your life and make you feel that way straight away.
I totally agree. So there's my like soapbox rant, my Thanksgiving story. So like if you have any comments about it, you know, send me a tweet on Twitter. I'd love to hear if it's like helped you at all, or if you're maybe doing something similar to your life. Fraser, do you want to tell us about one of our great sponsors for tonight?
Sure. We've picked up a new sponsor for this week, an organization, a company called Simply Fix It, who are in fact a Scottish company, so I can tell you a little bit more about them. They don't work in your area of the world, Bradley, but they certainly work in mine. Simply Fix It are a Scottish company that carries out iPad repairs for schools. They've just expanded their service to cover the whole of the UK, and the reason we're talking about them today is that they offer a real alternative to the Genius Bar for schools who have iPads that need to get repaired. They have Apple-certified technicians who carry iPad screen repairs for a fraction of the cost. The quality is great, and everything is tested every step of the way. I recently had some work done by these guys for a couple of iPads that we had in school, and we were chatting about, you know, what kind of comes up when an iPad gets repaired. And one of the things that I had noticed, Bradley, I don't know if you've seen this as well, that when people go for cheap screen repairs, quite often things come back like the proximity sensor doesn't work on the screen, or the camera's misaligned or something like that. And one of the things that Simply Fix It do is they test all the parts before the device goes back together, and they also sort of audit your device to make sure that they can fit it back together properly, which is great. So they're based in Edinburgh and Glasgow, and they have a collect and return service for any school in the UK. They're fixing hundreds of iPad screens every month, and each one comes with free return delivery, 100-day warranty, and an exclusive discount for teachers. So if you want to save money on iPad repairs without sacrificing quality, go to simplyfixit.co.uk/schools. And until the end of 2015, if you mention this podcast with your first repair, you will get 30% off the whole order, with no limit. So you got a whole cupboard full of broken iPads, get them all down there and mention this podcast, and you will get 30% off. So thanks to Simply Fix It for sponsoring the show this week.
So we are on our quarterly feedback review show. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough to do it every week. So you got the first question. Well, actually, I think you got all the questions because I think you tweeted about it.
Yeah, I just solicited a few of these on Twitter, and I thought some of the questions were really interesting.
So first one, what do we have?
Okay, so a friend of the internet, Marilyn Mann, came to me and he asked, what about donating equipment to schools? Are there any things to be aware of? Any any do's, any don'ts, and what's the kind of general situation with donating equipment to schools. So I had one thought for this, Bradley, which was, firstly, do schools even want used computer equipment?
I'm going to say no with an asterisk. Like, if it's old enough to where you're going to throw it away, then I don't want it either.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's more and more constraints around this kind of thing. I think there's a few things that came to my mind when I was thinking, you know, if somebody rocked up with a computer for me, would I take it and whatever? And some of the most, at the most basic level, there are things like hygiene might be an issue. You don't know who's had that computer. You know, if it's a desktop computer, what disgusting things might be lurking in the keyboard, for example. Although I have to say, children do a pretty good job of making computers disgusting by themselves very quickly. More importantly, things like electrical safety and subsequently things like insurance cover for used devices, that might be a question mark for some schools. But more importantly, two things: data protection and data security. Because most people don't really know how to properly erase a computer, I would say. I know technically how to do it, but I don't actually have the kind of equipment that I really would like to have in order to properly destroy hard drives. So my practice is typically just to take the hard drives out and put them in a drawer somewhere. And I heard once, Bradley, this story about one of the universities not far from here who actually literally have a room in the basement of a building which is just floor to ceiling stacked with all the hard drives the organization has ever owned, because they don't really, nobody quite has the confidence to send them away in case there's still data on them that might be important. Data protection laws in the UK are very strict and the fines are very, very high, so it's probably cheaper just to allocate a room somewhere in your university and just put them all in that cupboard from one point or another. And finally, data security. If you are taking a computer in from the outside, that would be a great way to infect a school with a virus if you chose to donate them a computer that's already infected. So schools would have to be pretty careful about that. They should be careful about it. I'm not absolutely sure that all of them would be, but those would be some of my concerns around about accepting used equipment from parents, friends of the school, members of the public, and so on.
Yeah, I've taken a hard drive to a bat to a hard drive once. That was real fun, but it didn't have any like mission critical data. And, we've had situations in the past where like people were getting rid of their desktop, going to, laptops. And it's like, hey, you want this like Dell? I bought 2004. And it's like, I always think like, what are we going to do with this? Like, it's already super old. Like, how long do we expect this to work at our school? And I don't mean that to be like, we don't appreciate the thought, but you know, what I would like is like someone says, hey, I had this like iPad 3 and I'm upgrading to an Air. Would you like the iPad 3? We could probably make use of that. You know, with iOS devices, to me, that would be like a little bit different of a story, because they have, it seemed to, you know, there's more things you can do with an old iOS device.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is quite often that if people are ready to give away a computer wholesale, it really has absolutely no other value, you know, and if it has no value to people, if you couldn't sell it for any money, it probably doesn't have enough value to be useful in a school either. Now, I'm aware that we're speaking from the point of view of schools in developed countries who have budgets for computers and things like that. And certainly if you were in a school in, you know, a developing country where there maybe wasn't, you know, government funding for computers or whatever, the story might be different. So, you know, it's not always the case that no school anywhere wants it. But, you know, if you're talking about an old desktop computer, the cost of shipping it is so high quite often that it becomes difficult to afford the logistics of that.
Yeah, one of the things to think about, too, from like an IT perspective is like your support cost. So I'm not looking to deploy anything that's going to then require me to babysit it. Like, I would rather buy something that doesn't require me to babysit it from a, you know, like if it's a PC, like do we have the restore disk if we need it? What about the drivers? One thing to consider too with Apple gear, particularly on the Mac side, is their vintage and obsolete policies. So I believe after 5 years, they go to vintage. And then after 7 years, they go to obsolete, and obsolete means you can no longer get parts from Apple on them. Which, I mean, a lot of it's like you could get third party, or if it's like a hard drive, you obviously buy that standard. But that's, you can just be aware of like Apple's policies there. But yeah, you know, If you've got a really, really old Mac, bring it and we can put it in a museum.
Yeah, well, there's always... That is another way to donate computers that can be useful is in computer science classes. Teachers are always looking for computers that they can just take apart and show the children the bits inside. Because so many of our computers today, you can't meaningfully take them apart. You know, it's not that you can't disassemble an iPad, but it's a more difficult proposition to do and may involve splintering glass and things like that. Whereas if you have, say, a desktop computer or even a slightly older laptop that can be reasonably disassembled and used as demonstration parts for a lesson about the parts of the computer, that's one way I kind of put old computers to later use as I do demonstration disassembly with them in front of classes and things like that, which is quite a good lesson. I was going to say one other thing, Bradley, is that quite often schools or school districts have specific policies around what platforms and what equipment they use. And I know in our local authority here, Cedar is an independent school, so we don't follow their policy, of course, but our local authority has a strict no Apple policy, which is based on, I think, the logic of just because, as much as anything else. But if you were to rock up to one of our local schools and say, hey, here's, you know, 5 iPads or whatever, they would not be able to make use of that because they would not be allowed to connect it to any systems or put it on the internet or anything like that. So that may be another reason why schools might say no to it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously those situations, it goes back to if you're an Apple school and someone wants to donate a PC, even if it's new, like you have to then fit it into your environment.
Yeah, which may cost you much more than the value of buying another Mac, you know. But I mean, there are reasons, Bradley, to think that schools might actually want equipment or other positive things you can do with it that aren't necessarily just handing over and setting up in a classroom. And one of the ones I thought is that there are established charities, at least in the UK and probably in the US as well, where you can give your old PC and they will sort of recondition it, wipe all the data from it and so on, and they may sell it for parts or whatever, and then or they might ship it out to Africa, or they might sell it for parts and get money in order to do something else. And one of the other ways I thought people could deal with this is if you could sell your old Mac for enough money to buy a Chromebook for the school, for example, or an iPad or something like that, which means that the school gets modern technology that is supportable and in date and everything. And because, you know, many of these computing devices have gotten a lot cheaper since you maybe bought this computer that you're trying to sell. If you could get £200 for that computer, much better to donate the £200 to the school and let them buy something modern that fits in with their systems than give them this old piece of equipment that probably doesn't quite match up with what it is they're doing right now.
Yeah, and because it's like it may be more difficult for them to even sell it if they wanted to. Like some organizations have policies against, you know, selling things of a certain value without approval of various committees. So yeah, just donate money to the tech department. Before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor. It's the fine folks at Jamp Software. Jamp, you guys know, provides IT staff with tools that power the use of Apple technologies in schools. It's Macs, iPads, iPhones, Apple TVs. They have a great app for teachers called Casper Focus that allows teachers to take control of their deployments in their classroom. It allows them to quickly gain a student's attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to the class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn more about Casper Focus and the Casper Suite at jampsoftware.com, jamfsoftware.com. So next question I had, this is not on the list. I had one that was emailed to me.
Okay.
Melissa asked about, does anybody know about a dictionary app or website that is appropriate for K-3 students? Like it does not explicitly define certain verbs for which the kids are not quite developmentally ready. Any suggestions? And I have no clue on this. And have you heard of anything?
Joe, I've never been posed that question. I do not know.
We'll leave that to the if the listener knows. Get in touch on Twitter or email, and then we can pass that along to Melissa. So again, looking for a K-3. Student dictionary.
Yeah, I don't know if you suppress the sort of profanity configurations in iOS, does it take them at the dictionary as well? I've never tested that. I don't know.
So next thing, Stephen McIntosh asked, what about Google Classroom? Like, I guess what are our thoughts on that?
Mm-hmm.
Mine are, it is ideal for a school that uses Chrome OS or laptops with a heavy Google Apps workflow. I think if you're using iPad, I would probably advise to look elsewhere.
Yeah, we spent a bit of time at the end of the last academic year looking at Google Classroom, and I am aware that there are new features in Classroom since then, but my perception then, and other teachers as well, was that it's a case of Google Classroom and iTunes U are sort of leapfrogging each other a little bit from time to time. And we have all, you know, we were an iTunes U school at the time, but we were exploring Classroom because there was a period of time where iTunes U couldn't do any of the kind of document hand-in work that it can do now. And at the same time, Classroom didn't, it was really more about announcements and assignments rather than learning content as such. And we have all since kind of said, well, okay, Classroom is interesting, but we're more focused now on iTunes U 3.0, which has got almost all the features of Google Classroom plus all the features that iTunes U already had. So I think iTunes U is more a slightly more comprehensive solution right now, mainly because I think it does a slightly better job of supporting creating a course of learning content as well as just, you know, managing the classroom and assignments. I mean, Google Classroom is well named. It's a tool for running your classroom, but it's not quite the same as a tool for creating a course. I think that's possibly fair to say. I haven't looked at Google Classroom, its latest version, so I have to give that caveat as well. But I think I would take your point, Bradley, that if a school is heavily into Chrome OS and heavily into Google Docs, then Classroom is a great way to create multiple versions of docs and distribute them and track them and so on. iTunes U is a much better iOS platform citizen in the sense that you can use things like OpenIn to create materials in other apps and move them into iTunes U. And I found myself, since iTunes U 3 came out, I have not logged into the iTunes U website once. In that time, I've been using it exclusively on my iPad, marking stuff on there, recording grades, creating materials on my iPad and putting them into iTunes U for students. That's now a real complete workflow for teachers, and it's really, really nice. So I think both of them are good for the platforms that they're native for. Obviously, iTunes U on a Chromebook is not a very good experience either. So I think it depends a little bit. You know, these are the natural consequences of your platform choice rather than you choose your platform because you like iTunes U or Google Classroom better. Fair to say? Yeah.
And Google Docs, well, and I would add to that that Google Drive and /Docs, all the siblings, is a real dumpster fire on iOS 9.
Oh, they are in a terrible state. Oh, my goodness. Yep. And if you have an iPad Pro as well, I can tell you it's doubly bad. I don't know what is going on over there, and I sincerely hope that it is. We've got a huge new version just about to ship because those apps are in a powerless state on iOS 9. They really are, and it's embarrassing to use them. Negativity. There you go. Sorry.
Yeah, it's true. Have we ever detected students breaking into internal systems or hacking in various ways? Me personally, no, because we stop at fifth grade, and so I don't have any experience with that. Mm-hmm. But I would have strict, if I was in an upper school, this would be a strict punishment.
Yeah, I read an article recently where a student was getting, had been reported to the police for trying to hack into computer systems in schools, and I tweeted, I said, look, I would absolutely do the same if I discovered that happening in my school. And people were kind of like, are you serious? You know, this is crazy. You know, why involve the police in that? But I'm like, well, you know, in the UK, that's a violation of the Computer Misuse Act to try and access a computer system without authorization. And, you know, if a child, you know, violated the knife crime laws or sexual assault laws in school, you would phone the police. So why do computer laws get a pass? So I agree with you. I would absolutely have, if it was a serious case, I would absolutely take a firm line on it. But I have primarily, Bradley, tried to organize my network such that there's nothing very much to hack inside the school. So almost everything that we do is in the cloud now, and our school network is essentially runs on a zero trust model where being on our network confers you no actual benefit as in terms of accessing our systems than being on any other network. So we do things like we secure teacher Google accounts with two-factor authentication. We have security audits for teacher computers and so on to make sure that everybody's keeping passwords fresh. And more teachers are moving to Touch ID devices, which is great and so on. And the only thing that's ever happened is I had one student a while ago who had figured out that there was a mechanism by which you could get basically pirated iOS games by going onto certain sketchy websites and downloading provisioning profiles, essentially using an enterprise distribution hack in order to get apps onto devices. And I detected that in the end by I was looking at the list of apps that were installed, and I noticed some apps. I have a certain set of search filters on my GSS that showed me there were certain apps that I knew I hadn't installed, and these devices shouldn't have apps that I hadn't installed on them. That's how I detected it. And then I set up a later configuration that said, search for any devices that have more than this number of configuration profiles on them, and that would detect any that had more than the ones that I had set out, and that would suggest that I should go and look at those devices. So we had some long conversations around that, but that was the only thing, and it didn't really affect very much, except it affected the stability of their iOS devices. I suspect one or two of them might have actually tried to jailbreak and maybe succeeded or failed, but I ended up spending quite a long time just getting their devices back to a stable state. That only happened once, and quite quickly after that, there came a new restriction in iOS, which was prevent installing configuration profiles. So I turned that on, and what that meant was that it was no longer possible for the user to put on those provisioning profiles themselves so that they can install those apps. So I think that door is closed now, but that's the only incident I've ever had in terms of people manipulating their iOS devices.
Yeah, you've basically moved your security model to an app-level security versus a network-level security, which is like the trend. I mean, Google's done that as well internally.
Yeah, there's a great paper on that, actually. I will try and find it for the show notes, but there's a really good paper by Google on essentially that model, where they're exposing their internal systems to the public internet so that they're no longer living under a false sense of security about security. And I think, it's one thing that I see over and over again when I go to schools is they've basically got a perimeter-based security model, which is just... it's straightforwardly obsolete in these days. You know, when the network environment is so dynamic, the constituency you're serving is so dynamic and so diverse and so varied, you've got to put your security up at that level rather than try and just circle the wagons around your network and hope that nobody ever brings anything in that you didn't authorize. Yet, many people are still running in that model.
Next question.
Okay.
Do we know of an app to clone Git repositories and commit on iOS?
Yes, I do. And I have just completely blanked on the name of it. It was mentioned on Twitter just the other day. I think it's called Working Copy. There's at least one or two, and if you search the App Store for Git client, you'll find at least two that are good. I'm pretty sure Working Copy was the name of the one that most people recommended when I asked for an answer to this one on Twitter. But there's nothing I know built into any text editor apps. It's all external stuff using OpenIn and so on to fix that. But yeah, there are ways to do that on iOS.
Before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor.
Okay.
It's fine folks at Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, and then provide feedback directly on the documents through rich annotation features such as the pen tool, text, and voice notes. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of iPad apps or by using Shobi's built-in tools. New to Shobi this year is the gradebook feature for Shobi Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review, and export student grades. More great features like student portfolios and parent access are coming to Shobi later on this year. Shobi Basic is 100% free, and individual teachers listening to this podcast will get the gradebook and enhanced annotation features of Shobi Pro for 30% off if they purchase it annually. I'm a big fan of annual purchases. So we'll learn more about that and start your paperless classroom today at Shobi.com, or just search for Shobi in the App Store, Shobie. Thanks to Shobi for sponsoring the show this week. So next question, what types of classroom-oriented features are still missing from apps in 2015?
Good question. I think this question comes from Adam Wolf, who is of Tap Typing fame.
Yes.
So Tap Typing is a great iOS training app for typing, and we've been using that frequently this year. So Adam's question, what types of classroom features are still missing from apps in 2015? The number one, Bradley, I put down there was support for the share sheet. I cannot believe how many apps don't just do that and nothing else. The biggest offenders, of course, being Microsoft, who have been the bane of my entire life this year because, you know, you can take documents into Word, but there's no real good way to just get a document back out of Word without sending it as an email, which is, you know, mid-2000s level of productivity. So number one by miles for me is support the share sheet. What do you think?
Yeah, that's, I mean, anything built into iOS, you should just support natively.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I think that's a no-brainer at this point. We're running into something this week. We use a program called Advanced Reader.
Mm-hmm.
It's our reading comprehension software. They have an iPad app that we're having some issues with. Like, it will fail at the end of the quiz. It's a reading comprehension quiz system.
Yep.
And like, when it gets to the last page, it'll like complain about no like loss of connection. Happens the same spot on every iPad.
Yeah.
They're saying it's on our end. I assure them it's not. Or, you know, if you take it on a computer using wireless, it works fine. Can you guess when their last app update was?
It's an educational app, isn't it? I'm going to say 2014 sometime.
August of 2014.
Oh,
so that means it has not been updated even since iOS 8 came out.
Yay. Educational software.
So, yay. Of course, again, I'm paying $2,000 a year for this whole thing.
This is the worst. It's insult to injury, isn't it?
I would be annoyed if it hadn't been updated since August of this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let alone last year.
Yeah.
But yeah, please tell me how it's on my end with my 400 meg symmetrical connection, a rock solid Aerohive network. Yeah. Please, and we just all of a sudden started having the problem like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Please tell me how it's on my end.
Yeah. Because you went ahead and changed iOS.
Well, I can make it happen on iOS 8 or an iOS 9
mm-hmm.
iPad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I just think that something's wonky on their end, and it's like, it's always our fault, but yeah. So stability is one, a big one. Just like stuff needs to work,
yep.
Particularly stuff I'm paying for yearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stability and long-term support as well. You know, I mean, like deployments run in a 3 to 4 year schedule, and you know, I want to be able to, you know, teach children apps and then have them be able to use those apps, you know, multiple years in a row. I don't want to have to keep teaching them new apps for the same thing every year. And to be fair about, you know, I've been doing this for nearly 6 years now, and there haven't been that many apps that we have adopted that have since, like, completely disappeared. There's one or two, but not many. And for the most part, the apps that we started with are still either still working, although albeit looking quite dated now, or have been updated frequently over the course. So it's, you know, people keep saying, you know, developers make no money in the App Store and nobody's going to commit to their apps for a long time. But my experience hasn't borne that out. I think I'm seeing much better than I expected levels of long-term support for these apps. We've got apps we've been using consistently for 5 years now on iOS, and they're getting better all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where you kind of should maybe research how long an app's been around, how often is it updated, and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Next thing, you have a prompt updating for new iOS versions and devices.
Yeah. So I want stability and I want prompt updates at the same time. But I don't see that those two things are necessarily completely at odds with each other. And what I'm talking about is things like, you know, iPhone 6 Plus comes out. You know, there are apps I'm downloading new today that don't support that. There are certainly apps that don't support iPad Pro. Okay. Apps that don't support iOS multitasking. Things like that, you know, those things have only been out a few months, but already it's painful with the apps that don't support it. So, you know, being aware of and planning for the things that Apple are doing. I wonder, you know, a little bit, you know, some developers are kind of new to Apple and new to iOS, and they don't really know how to read the tea leaves of what Apple says at WWDC as meaning we're going to do something about this in the very near future, such as size classes come along and then all of a sudden there's two bigger iPhones. You know, everybody else figured that out. All the old school Apple people figured that out, but some of the newer people maybe not quite so much.
Well, and I would add, like, just communicate your plans for your timeline on, like, okay, we expect to have iPad Pro support for this date.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, this month. Just keep us in the loop on what's going on, particularly for more premium products.
Yeah.
Next thing is control ad inventory.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, continues to be a symptom of the free app model.
Mm-hmm.
And so totally agree here.
Yep. I was sort of inspired to write this down because the YouTube Kids app just launched in the UK this week. I know it's been in the US for a while. And they do a job in there of trying to make sure that the ad inventory is appropriate and things like that.
Good app, though.
Most apps are okay with that, but you know, like the Game of War ads and stuff like that aren't super appropriate for young kids.
Yeah, or pop-ups that are hard to dismiss in general.
Yeah, those sort of dark UX patterns that people try. Very frustrating.
Yeah, but yeah, that seems to be getting better. But yeah, the YouTube Kids app is really, really fantastic.
Yeah, I've only just started. I just downloaded it today, so I'm going to have a little play with it. We've had a big problem in school because we have deployed the YouTube app in the past, and it recently went 17+. So the problem we had with that was because when kids updated their iPads, the app went above the maximum age rating that they were allowed to use on their iPads. But the app was still installed. So the problem was, you know, when you go to Safari with a YouTube URL and it offers to kick you into the app. Well, on iOS 9, it still offers to kick you into the app, but because you can't run the app, nothing happens and the page doesn't load in Safari either. So kids were just like, there's no access to YouTube at all. I said, you know, kids, this is what it's like to be in any other school, so get used to it for a while. So I have had to go around and pick YouTube off of everybody's iPad one by one, which is super frustrating. But we'll probably start rolling out the YouTube Kids app fairly soon if we just make sure that it can access all the content we need it to.
You had one more here, support for MDM delivered settings dictionary.
Yeah, so this is a thing that was new, I think, in either iOS 7 or iOS 8. I think iOS 8, where you can basically put a dictionary, a property list, into your MDM server, and it can deliver settings to an iOS app over the air. So let's say you had, let's say it was the YouTube Kids app, and you wanted to pre-configure the parental control passcode or whatever. Let's assume that's stored in the settings dictionary. You could set up a dictionary, send that out to all the iPads, and when the kids open up that app, instead of going through the setup screens and everything, it will actually just appear pre-configured for them because you've delivered the configuration for the app over MDM. I don't know how many apps support this, and I don't know any way to discover whether apps do support it or not, except to just sort of try it, and I haven't really bothered trying it because no apps have said that they support it either. So if you do support this, make it obvious or make it clear in some way that you do support it, and then sysadmins might start using that feature a little bit more.
Next thing, next question. What about functionality of external keyboards with iPad Pro?
Mixed bag right now. I'm using my iPad Pro with, I've got a Logitech K760 keyboard and also an Apple Bluetooth keyboard that I use at school. There are numerous multiple bugs in iOS 9.1 on the iPad Pro involving keyboards, which is unfortunate considering that is one of the headline features of the device. One of which is that quite often the on-screen keyboard pops up even though you've got a Bluetooth keyboard attached, which is quite annoying. And secondly, particularly in Google Docs, it is prone to doubling keystrokes. So if you hit delete, it'll delete two spaces. And sometimes it will insert two things as well. So a little bit buggy right now. I've heard that 9.2 fixes a lot of these problems, but I have not tried to beat it on my iPad Pro yet.
How's that device in? Like a weekend? Still loving it?
Yeah, still loving it. You know, the thing that's starting to get me more over the period is just straightforward performance. It is so fast. It's really fast, and multitasking is very smooth for the apps that support it, which is great. I'm using the pencil a bit less, but I am using it very much in class. I tend to use Explain Everything as my kind of whiteboard app. So I'll throw the iPad up on the Apple TV and then just use Explain Everything on my iPad with the Apple Pencil. And it's very easy to do very precise stuff in there. So that's great. The other thing I'm really loving about it is the on-screen keyboard, having all those extra keys right on the front keyboard is a huge big time saver. So being able to type numbers without flipping a keyboard and so on is great. I'm still trying to lose some of the muscle memory, you know, for some of the old tricks like swiping up on the comma key to get the apostrophe key and things like that. You can still do that swipe up trick, but it's not on that key anymore. It's on the actual apostrophe and inverted comma key. So things like that, I'm still trying to break old habits of many years. But yeah, the iPad Pro is a really great machine.
How has your battery life been?
Well, when I restored from the backup of my iPad Air 2, and it was terrible, I was down to, you know, 15% battery by the end of the school day. You know, so from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., the iPad was practically dead. I then erased it all and I set it up from scratch again, and the battery life has been great. It's a little bit heavier than the iPad Air 2 was, but it's nothing that I can't live with now. So now I'm coming home 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock with 50, 45% on the battery and going to sleep with 30%, whereas times past I was getting down to much lower numbers. Now there's also a wee bit of a kind of... you know, I can't stop playing with a new toy sort of effect there as well. It's always hard to evaluate battery life in the first week of owning a device, but there was clearly something not right about just how much battery was going how quickly on my first setup. So I'm much happier with it now as well.
So last question, do we get free stuff from Apple? And I will add that I do not. I've never gotten a free... free item from Apple or even a review unit. So I would accept review units, though.
Yeah. The only thing I've ever had from Apple is food. And, well, is that true? I have never received free equipment in return for nothing from Apple. You know, so I've never had a gift from Apple of any kind. I know from dealing with a lot of people at Apple that Apple's rules are in gifting are extremely strict. In fact, they're some of the strictest that I've ever heard of. Apple people go through ethics training on this issue. I think they have to do every quarter. They have to go through ethics training. So Apple simply doesn't gift anything to anybody. You know, and the far more important people than me that don't get gifts from Apple as well. Apple do hire people like me to do events. But that's obviously payment in return for a service, such as, you know, speaking at an event or a workshop or something like that through the Apple Distinguished Educator Program or the Apple Apple Learning Tours and things like that. So that's a separate thing. But in terms of, you know, do we get free Apple Watches? Do we get free iPad Pros? No. All of my equipment was paid for. My school pays for its equipment. We don't get much in that way for free at all. I say much, we don't get anything for free. The only thing we ever got was our Apple Distinguished Schools certificate, which was quite nice. But no, we do not get anything free from Apple.
Maybe one day we'll get a free iPad.
Yeah, buy 500, get one free. I don't know.
So I think that's a good place to leave it for this week. If you're in the U.S., I hope you have a great Thanksgiving, and if you're off from work this week, hope you have a fun time with family and friends and watching American football and eating turkey.
Sounds good. I love how you guys have like a practice Christmas just before Christmas. So great.
Oh, yeah. And we have and sweet potatoes with marshmallows on them are a vegetable.
Yep. Well, your Congress says pizza's a vegetable, right? So yeah.
Not even a dessert. So thanks to our sponsors this week. Jamp, Shobi, and Simply Fix It. We'll have links to all of their websites in the show notes at outofschool.net or in the podcast app of your choice. And any links we mentioned, we will list them as well. I am Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
Okay, and I'm spears.org on the web and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
Have a great week, everybody.